My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And if I hadn't become an alcoholic, I probably wouldn't have become anything. And I think as I tell my story, you'll understand what I mean by that. I first want to thank the committee for inviting me. I needed to be here this weekend more than you needed me here. I've been going through a lot of losses this year. I buried a very, very close friend. This friend that died of AIDS. My roommate is moving to Hawaii the 1st of September. It's breaking up a very close relationship. Another very, very close friend, and probably the person that knows me the best, besides my sponsor, is moving out, is being transferred. So I've been going through all these losses in my life. And I had forgotten about the fellowship and about the love that's in this program. And I've gotten that here this weekend. It started when Edie and Ellen picked me up Wednesday at the plane. It's that rejuvenation, that just letting myself be loved by you people. And that's been real important for me here. And I want to thank you very, very much. The speakers have been incredible. And if just being asked isn't enough, to be with the lineup of speakers that I've been is just incredible. Let's give all the other speakers a big hand. I'm going to open my talk with something that I do every time I speak, and it's real important for me because it's from the textbook. It's from There Is a Solution, and it's what it allows me to open up and tell you exactly what it was like for me. And it goes like this: we are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner. Excuse me. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the power of. Excuse me. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree and from which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries for those who suffer from alcoholism. Like Lisa said, I think there's a lot of things in that happened to me as a child and before I took my medicine for the first time that are real important in my story. I ran away from home on my tricycle. Serious, before I was even in school, I was a juvenile delinquent. My mother told me numerous times as a child and in later years that if she knew what I was going to be like, she'd have strangled me with my umbilical cord. And I think that has permeated a lot of how I felt about myself throughout my life. And it wasn't until I got here that I was able to let go of a lot of that. I'm one of these people that I don't remember dates that happened in my sobriety. I think John was real clear, and Lisa and some of the others, about when they took their first drink and when this happened and when that happened. I don't remember those dates. I was exposed to AA for about 4 years before I got here, and I know that I was drunk on Christmas, but I wasn't drunk at New Year's. So my sponsor and I talked about it, and and discuss it. And we picked December 28th. That feels like a good date. It was in there somewhere. And on December 28th of last year, I celebrated 12 years of continuous sobriety. And that's an absolute miracle, because in the end, I couldn't go 4 hours without a drink. You know, I know I started smoking at age 11. I don't know when I took my first drink. I saw my first alcohol-related jail at age 14. And I'm one of these people that never crossed the line. I'd already crossed the line before I was born. I don't know what it is to drink socially. I never drank socially. I mean, there was never enough for me. I didn't drink to drink. I drank to get drunk. You know, I drank. And I tried drugs, but they didn't get what I wanted. And what I wanted was blackouts. I wanted to escape the pain that I was in. I was hated as a child. I was from the wrong side of the tracks. I only played or had friends with people that were poorer than I was. And the only difference between them and us was they had dirt floors and we didn't. You know, I don't know what it is as a child to get a lot of new school clothes and all that other things that kids got. And we got a pair of shoes and a pair of jeans when school started. And that was the extent of my school clothes. I didn't do well academically. Being a juvenile delinquent, school wasn't for me. I wanted out. I wanted to drink. You know, and alcohol gave me that escape at a very, very young age. I was born and raised in a little town in northern Minnesota, population at that time of about 600. So everybody knew what everybody was doing. So everyone knew I was a juvenile delinquent. I was looked down upon and beat up. And I got out of there as fast as I could. I mean, I didn't even go to my graduation party or anything. And my suitcase was packed, and I was in Minneapolis as soon as graduation was over. And at that time, drinking age was 21. But if you're young, blonde, blue-eyed, Scandinavian, the streets of Minneapolis were wonderful, you know. There was a lot of people that would give you what you wanted just for to be with you. And in later years, that kept me alive, being young, blonde, blue-eyed Scandinavian. I did a lot of things to my body, with my body, just to stay alive. You know, just to make it on the streets of Minneapolis. And I drank as much as I could whenever I could, from ages 18 till age 30, when I finally got the miracle. I lived on the streets. I wasn't going to pay rent. I mean, that was good drinking money. I mean, why waste it? I mean, you know, I don't mix drinks. I never did mix drinks. That was a waste. You know, I drank from the brown paper bag. And my last drunk lasted me 3 months shy of 2 years. And the only time I drew a sober breath during that time was when they stopped me. I couldn't stop on my own. John talked about the freedom of choice, you know, Friday night, and that is one of the greatest gifts, I think, of this program, is the freedom of choice. Because when I was drinking, I had no choices. The bottle made every choice for me. You know, just to qualify myself, I'm going to tell you a few things of what happened to me. As I said, I was living on the streets, in and out of jails, detoxes. My record Now, in Minnesota, you have to understand, the law says if you're picked up for public intoxication, you can pay for 72 hours. Well, every time I was in there for 72 hours. There was a detox center. And my record is 7 times in 1 month. Now, if you count that up, that's 21 days out of a month I spent in detox. I mean, I would be out in the morning and we'd get a jug and I was back in. And that's how I lived. I have a very specific recollection where it was 8 o'clock, liquor stores opened at 8 o'clock. We had just gotten a jug. We were in the park drinking. Police came along and picked us up. And they said we were going to detox. That didn't bother me because I was going home. What bothered me was that they got my jug of alcohol. You know, I mean, they got, and they just capped it. I mean, there was that whole bottle gone to waste. And that's how I lived. You know, as I said, I lived on the streets. And Minnesota, it gets very, very cold in the winter. And I worked daily labor, which is an alcoholic's dream. You go in the morning, you get sent out. You come back and they pay you cash that day. Well, you know, that was wonderful. And I had worked that day, and I had worked in a restaurant, and it was very wet, and my feet were freezing, and I lived, if you want to call it that. I mean, they tease me now about having one of the best addresses in town, Nicollet Mall, which is the main street in town. A lot of very exclusive places on there. But there was one where there was a bank, and it was recessed, and there was a little cubby hole with hedges in front of it. And I could crawl back in there, and that was my home. And I remember one night, it was probably 20 below, 25 below somewhere, that was in the middle of winter, and my feet were freezing. And I knew if I didn't do something, I was going to freeze to death. So I walked out, dug through the garbage cans and found newspapers, and wrapped my feet in newspapers to keep from freezing to death. And the horror of all of that is that I was living like that because I truly believed I couldn't have what I have today. Because I had already experienced AA at that time. Been to several meetings as a result of being in and out of detox. The counselor that I got every time, would talk to me about AA, and you people would come up and put on meetings, and I would go because it was something to do. And you were, as the big book says, happy, joyous, and free. And I could see it in your faces and your eyes. And I can remember sitting there thinking, you know, you may not be drinking, but I'm sure you're smoking funny cigarettes or something. But there was no way. There was no way people could be that happy without some sort of chemical in your body. And so that just continued and continued and continued. And I remember standing on the bridge. There's a bridge that crosses the Mississippi River. And wanting to die in the worst way. And I wanted to jump. And I couldn't. I just could not kill myself. And I believe it's one of those times when God was holding me in the palm of his hand and doing for me what I could not do for myself. I mean, I just couldn't do it. I mean, and I was at that point where it talks about in the big book, that the alcoholic will reach a point that he cannot differentiate the truth from the false. You know, and I was at that point, and I wanted to die. So I went about killing myself the only way I knew how, and that was to drink myself to death. Now, living on the streets, my Every morning, when I took that first drink, wherever I could get it, I knew it was coming back up. So I had to be someplace that I knew that I could. And every morning I threw up blood. And that lasted for almost a year. When I got into this program, got into the state hospital where I sobered up, the amazing thing, and it's another one of those times when God held me in the palm of his hand, I have no physical damage whatsoever to myself. I mean, it's amazing that I even have a liver left, but there was none. I was malnourished, of course, but I have no damage. As I said, I had been to meetings on and off, and I remember one meeting in particular. I was sitting in the back of the room. People up front were talking about this slumber party they were having, all-night slumber party, and I thought, you guys are nuts. I really need a drink. And I didn't want any part of that. Ironically, one of the people talking about that slumber party is my sponsor and has been for 12 and a half years. So it just continued that way. And I don't know what happened. I don't know why. I sobered up when I did. I've heard it said that God's kids can see when they can see, and they can hear when they can hear. And I guess I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. And as I said, I got the same counselor every time I was in the detox center. And I went in on, I was malnourished. And in fact, I had called, his name was Pat. And another one of those ironic things is, been to meetings on and off. And I remember one meeting in particular. I was sitting in the back of the room. People up front were talking about this slumber party they were having, all-night slumber party, and I thought, you guys are nuts. I really need a drink. And I had lost all identification. I lost my wallet, absolutely everything, but I never lost Pat's car. And I called him that day and said, I need to go to treatment. And he said, well, you get here to detox right now. And I got over there, and he pulled me in his office, and the next morning, and he said, are you serious about going to treatment? And I said, yes. And the relief just flooded through his face, because he had tried and tried and tried to talk me into going to treatment, and I would never go. That was probably some of the best therapy for me, was to sit there, because they couldn't get me into treatment. Now, I had no money, so I was on the county, I was on the state to go to a treatment center. And they couldn't get me in right away. So after about 3-4 days, the fog starts to clear a little bit, and you start to see what's going on around you. And in fact, during that period, Pat had called me in his office and said, it's going to be about 10 days before you can go. Do you need to go out and take care of anything? You can come back in then. And a voice said, and it wasn't mine, no, don't let me out of here, because I'll never come back. So I sat there for 10 days. Now, what I saw was myself. I saw the people that were talking to the doorknobs. I saw the people going into DTs. I saw myself if I continued. See, that I had all, and what I know now is that I had gone through the DTs because I saw the snakes on my arms, the spiders coming out of the light sockets, voices of people that were impossible for them to be in that room, but they were talking to me. And I know today now that those were hallucinations. And it's much like Lisa says about kissing the doors of death. I mean, that's how close I was at that time. And that was very good for me. I spent 45 days in a 28-day treatment program. It was at State Hospital, which again was very, very good for me. I mean, we were separated for the program part of it, but we ate with the general population. And I saw again what happens to people that don't quit drinking. You know, today I work in the field of mental health, and I'm absolutely astounded at the number of people that I deal with that are mentally ill as a result of alcohol or drugs. It's just astounding. And I saw myself, and I saw I saw the people doing what we call the Anoka Shuffle in Minnesota, but it's in a lot of other parts of the country it's called the Thorazine Shuffle, where it takes you half an hour to make a corner, you know. And that was me. I mean, I was that close to being that. When I got there, I mean, I went in with clothes on my back, and that's all I had. They had to start from scratch. I mean, I hardly knew my own name. Somehow the counselor picked up that I needed to be taught responsibility, so they made me the hall monitor and all this other good stuff. And people had been telling me all my life that I needed to get responsible. And I could never figure out what that is. And I heard a speaker say once, and it's real important to me, responsibility is the ability to respond to your surroundings. And that made sense to me. And I didn't have it. You know, as I said, I was there 45 days. I had, throughout my drinking, I come from a very fundamentalist religious background. So, and I had rejected the church. I had rejected God at a very, very early age. And so when I finally got into these rooms, and I think it's part of what kept me from sobering up, I would look at the steps as they were on the wall, and I rejected them because they had God in it, because I didn't believe in God. So I spent a lot of time working on other than doing steps 1 through 5 in treatment, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out this God crap, as I call it. And there was a woman minister that came in and did spiritual counseling, and we spent like 4 hours together just talking about spirituality and God and all that other stuff. And what we finally came up with, and it works for me, and if it works for you, fine. And if it doesn't, that's fine too. See, I had such a hang-up about religion, and I wasn't able to separate that from spirituality. And what works for me is this. Religion is the love and manifestation of a person outside of yourself. Spirituality is the love and manifestation of a person inside of yourself. And that I could accept. My concept of God today is totally changed. My belief is that if there is a God, it's not the one that we see in the churches today. He's not the vengeful, hateful, damning one that churches teach us about. Because if that was the case, none of us would be here. You know, it was a miracle I sobered up. And in fact, there's a line in the 12x12 that Bill W. wrote that says, you know, it's truly awful to think that glass in hand, we have warped our mind into such a pattern of obsessive drinking that nothing short of an act of providence can remove it. And that's not the God I grew up with. You know, My God is all loving, all caring. He only wants the best for me. And as I was in treatment, groups would come in. Now, having compromised myself, and it talks about big book, and having compromised myself to the point that I no longer felt the compromise, and seeing every living being as the enemy and hating you, till the point that I no longer felt the hate, I thought I was too dirty. I thought I would never be accepted in this program. And there was a group of people that came in, and I'm so grateful to them, because they came in and started taking me to meetings outside of the state hospital. And I was trying to grasp this program somehow, because it was the only thing left. I had tried everything else, and it didn't work. I couldn't kill myself. I couldn't make it without drinking. And they took me under their wing, kind of, and came and got me, and took me to meetings, and I was talking to one of the gals in the meeting, and trying to get this, and just really hating myself, and feeling real dirty, and real ashamed of what I had done. And she told me something that's very, very important to me. She put a big book in my hand, and she told me I was an absolutely beautiful child of God, that I was not bad, that I was sick, and if I wanted what she had, follow her. And that's what I did. I become a student of the big book. It is our basic text. Mine is all written up, scratched, highlighted, and that's been real important for me. And I watched this woman, and my sponsor was going to that meeting, I had forgotten how it was to live without alcohol or any other way. And I would watch people as they came in to the meeting, how they dressed, what colors they put together. Because I had forgotten, I didn't know. I still get uncomfortable. I go out to a very nice restaurant, there's more than two forks, and I don't know what to do. It took me a long time to figure out the short one was the salad fork. I just didn't know. And I followed those people, and I watched because I wanted what they had. There was something about that group that I wanted what they had. I carried my sponsor's phone number in my pocket for almost a year because I couldn't remember his name or his number. I would pull it out to call him. He made me call him every day. And that was part of teaching me some discipline, was to call him every day. I had to be taught from day one. I was told, and it's happened to me, that the things I did in my first year of sobriety were the things that would save my life the rest of my life. And it's absolutely true. I went to a meeting every day that first year, every single day. I lived in a halfway house. I couldn't work. I didn't have any profession other than prostitution and burglary, practically. And those things have kept me sober the rest of my life. I've absolutely experienced it where my feet are going to a meeting and my heart was going to a bar. It saved my life. I started working the steps, and my sponsor says, take them off the wall and put them in the big book. And I worked the steps from the big book, not off the wall. I really appreciate what Lisa said about the four step, you know, that I mean, some of us came in here, most of us, probably even more than most, came in here with such sexual hang-ups or sexual problems, and we don't talk about that in AA. And yet the old-timers thought it was important enough, you know. They devoted a whole quarter of the inventory to it, you know, and we don't talk about it in AA. We need to. I mean, I came in here with such beliefs about sex that I needed to work through them. And I'm real glad my sponsor was there for me to do that. And I knew there had to be a power or something or God or something that was going to keep me sober, because I had never been able to do it by myself. The big book talks about, you know, lack of power. That was our dilemma. You know, this spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. You know, we have to find a power that can keep us sober. And for a long time, the groups and my sponsor were my higher power. I mean, my sponsor is what kept me sober. He's the one that kind of got me and took me to a meeting, you know, told me to shut up and listen. And it's I consider myself today to be a very spiritual man. I'm not a religious man. I go to several meetings. One is in the basement of a church, and we're walking down the hall, and every once in a while I'm going, F it, F it, F it, F it. A friend of mine turned to me and says, "What are you doing?" You know, I said, "I'm swearing in church." You know, I don't have any resentments, of course, but... And I had to find a power that was not connected with the church, and I've been able to do that. It's how it's worked for me is that, I mean, it's like talking to Herman. You know, if I don't talk to Herman, I wouldn't get to know him. And I've had to do that with my power. You know, I choose to call it God. But I've had to talk to him. I've had to sit still and let him come into my life and do what needs to be done. About 5 years sober, I was what the big book calls restless, irritable, and discontent. I was going to meetings. They weren't working for me. There's a group that I was very involved in, and now I had about 5 years sobriety, and they had like 12 years at that, 11 years, 10 years. And they were planning a Thanksgiving dinner for people that had nowhere to go. And they started arguing over the guest list. And and I went to my sponsor, and I said, you know, if that's what long-term sobriety is, I don't want it, you know. And sponsors, like old-timers, sometimes I think they have brain damage, you know. I mean, John says, "You're absolutely right, you know, you don't want it." He said, "David, learn from that. Learn that when you get to be 12 and 13 years old, that's not how you want to be." Well, I needed to make a geographical cure. I've done it sober. I had gone to a conference in Kansas City, Missouri, and I met some people from Omaha, and just had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time. And also at that conference, there was a woman that spoke that I've heard speak before and has been huge influence on my life. I was still trying to get this higher power stuff and this God. And she talked about in her story, and she tells a little story, and it makes sense to me too, that we can think of our higher power or God as you know, with all of our drinking, you know, our minds are like great libraries, and the books have been pulled out, torn up, the pages thrown around, and our higher power is that little man that comes in at night and rebinds those books and puts them back on the shelf. And he's also the one that makes sure when we lay down at night that our heart is beating, that our temperature is what it's supposed to be. And I could comprehend what she was talking about. And I grasped that. And that is what I think is one of my spiritual experiences. When I made the decision to move to Omaha, Nebraska, as I said, I was restless, irritable, discontent, and I surrendered for the second time in Omaha. And I think most of us go through the second surrender. I was reintroduced to Big Book AA. I'd gotten away from it. I was reintroduced to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember sitting in one of their meetings in the back room, arms across my chest. You know, I don't know anybody here. Well, they made me greeter at the door. I got to meet a whole lot of people real fast. There you didn't just say hi, you shook their hand and said, "My name is David, welcome to the meeting." And I got to meet a whole lot of people. And I had left a fairly decent job here in Minneapolis, and was living in Omaha, and I had taken a severe cut in pay. Spiritually, things were wonderful. I was reconnected with AA. I was reconnected with God. But on October 7th, 1987, I surrendered for the second time. And I totally surrendered. There were no more deals. I mean, I was one of these people that throughout this period, I mean, there were things that I would give to God to do, to work on, but I kept some of them. And what happened was that I had to surrender totally. You know, and I got down on my knees for the first time ever on that night and gave it all to God. And my life hasn't been the same since. As a result of that one phone call, I got my old job back within a week. I was back in Minneapolis. I mean, it was just that quick. I mean, it was God doing for me what I could not do for myself again. I came back, and this gal kept telling me about this incredibly wonderful Big Book study group that was meeting at the Cavalier Club, and that I should go because I was looking for Big Book AA again. So I went, and I didn't see her there. So the next time I talked to her, you know, I said, "Well, I went to the meeting. Where were you?" "So I don't go to that meeting." You know, and it was another one of those God that someone in my life to get me to that meeting. I've been at that meeting ever since. And if you're ever in Minneapolis, meet at the Cavalier Club on Thursdays, 5:45. I've through that meeting. I've gotten involved in service. I've become a student of the Big Book again. It's truly amazing to me how sometimes some of us with a little length of sobriety forget that the things that worked at 1 year, 2 year, we think they're not going to work at 10, 11, 12. You know, I was talking to a friend a couple months ago, and it was like, throughout what I've been going through, you know, what makes me think that the things that I did when I first sobered up aren't going to work now? The gratitude list. My sponsor has, when I first sobered up, had me do a gratitude list. And then, you know, I was grateful I was in a warm place. I was grateful I could brush my teeth, take a bath, you know. And I need to be brought back to that absolute simplicity of the program. You know, that whatever is going on in my life, I need to be reminded that the greatest miracle has already happened. And for me, that's physical sobriety. You know, all the rest of this is just icing on the cake. You know, whether I have a good job, the right car, you know, the right lover, I mean, any of that, that's immaterial to me. The most important thing is I'm sober. So I started doing that, and it's working. Those simple, basic things that kept me sober first are keeping me sober today. Somebody asked me once, you know, after your years of sobriety, does it get easier? And I said, no, it gets simpler. I complicate it, you know. And it's very true. You know, that absolute basic. There's a couple things that happened that I want to talk about, and then I'm going to sit down. My dad left when I was a very, very young age, and I never saw him again until in 1988 when he passed away, and he passed away sober. When I had made the decision to move to Omaha, most of my family went crazy. My mother, in fact, one of her comments was about moving to the hellhole of the world or some awful thing like that. And my dad called, and you have to realize, I had never known my father. I have no recollection of him being around when I was a child. And he came back into my life. He moved back to sobered up and moved in with his father to take care of my grandpa. I went home, I was living in Omaha at the time. I went home and I walked into my brother's house and my dad and I passed. We didn't even know who we were. He didn't know I was his son. I didn't know he was my father. So we were reintroduced to each other. And what happened as a result of all of that is that all those questions and all those things about who my father was, what he was like, were removed. And when I was moving to Omaha, he was the only one that called and said, is there anything I can do? Do you need to store something? You know, is there anything I can help you with? So I had gotten to know my father. I mean, we started to develop a relationship. And he died very, very suddenly. And he had said to my sister-in-law on Sunday that he needed to call me. And he died on Tuesday and never made the phone call. So I came back for the funeral. And they had done the, at the graveside service, he was a veteran, they had done the last rites and all that other stuff. Taps were over. And the family was moving away. And I felt a real urge to just stand there. And I stood by his grave. And I got this incredible rush of freedom and of forgiveness. And it was like my dad could go in peace, and so could I. You see, my God loves me very, very much. And he wants no holes in my soul, you know. And that day, another piece of me healed. It's an incredible experience. As I said, I'm going to talk about this and then I'm going to sit down. I lost a very, very close friend, May 5th. He died of AIDS. Now, he was the type, I mean, him and I were, we laughed that our mothers were stirred with the same stick. I mean, there was just this incredible connection between him and I. First time I saw him in a meeting, I mean, it's kind of like I was, because he was sitting in the knee hole of a desk, and that's where he felt safe, that's where he felt comfortable. As he was getting sick, we got to spend a lot of time together, talking about death, talking about life. And I watched this man that came from the same place I did about God and spirituality, and I watched him transform over the years to a very incredibly, incredibly spiritual man. He was ready for death. He accepted it. The day that he died, he died at home, and we had a schedule set up where there were two of us that would sit 24 hours with him. Now, that day, it was not my day to sit with him, and yet I ended up at the house, and there were three or four others that did. And I realize now that was God moving me there to be a part of that. The end was coming. We knew it was coming. They had called me on Friday at work to come. He was dying. I went. He rallied. Sunday morning at 5 o'clock, the nurse called me. She was sure he was dying. She would say my name and he would squint his eyes. There was no communication at that point. And so I went, he rallied. Well, he finally let go Monday evening and we were all there. And I had an experience. Death is very painful, but it's also very beautiful. I mean, much like Lisa was talking about. Because we were there when he died. And his family was there. They were from Iowa, small town in Iowa. The family's minister was there, and after Greg passed away, the nurse brought us all into the room, and we washed him up, combed his hair, and he had already expired at this point, and put on his favorite shirt, his favorite pants, and had a little service. We lit an AIDS candle, held hands, said goodbye. And the minister was there and watched all of this. And after we had done that and the body was gone and we were all sitting around, we heard him on the phone. And we don't know who he was talking to, but what he said was that he had never had the experience of experiencing an AIDS-related death. And what he saw that night was one of the most spiritual things he had ever saw. Now, this was coming from a minister. And I turned to a friend of mine, and I said, you know, thank God I'm sober, that I get to experience that. That I get to take care of someone in life and in death. You know, it was an absolutely, absolutely incredible experience. As I said, I want to thank you for being here. I'm really nervous, so I'm just going to sit down. It's been an incredible weekend. Thank you very much.